You are listening to the Tour des Flâneurs, the cycling podcast at the 2022 Tour de France, powered by Super Sapien, energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Stage 21, today bring Paris.
François Thomazeau, we've made it. We completed the Limoges to Paris Classic. Not the most exciting parkour on the autoroute, was it? But we left Rocamadour last night and got north to Limoges just to chisel off a bit of the long journey up to Paris. And we did the rest this morning. And we've arrived for the final stage of the Tour de France. And it's a familiar feel. All the team buses are parked just off the Place de la Concorde. Team staff are kind of allowing themselves to just relax a little bit. I've seen the Intermarché soigneurs and mechanics coming back with a big pile of pizza boxes for everyone to eat, while the riders finish the hard work of racing up and down the Champs-Élysées and bringing the curtain down on the Tour de France.
Yeah, it's a little bit ironical that the riders will be treated to pizza boxes tonight when we're actually standing in front of the Maxim's, which is one of the most famous restaurants in Paris and pretty posh and very, very expensive, but it's closed on Sundays, obviously, so that's probably why they went for Pizza Hut or whatever it is. But anyway, there we are. Yeah, you wanted us, I think, Lionel, to have a little survey of how the teams performed in this Tour de France as we walk along the buses. And yeah, just in front of us, as you said, Intermarché, Wanty, Gobert. Verdict?
Well, I think they've probably performed to par, haven't they? Louis Menkes came into the race hoping for a top 10 position, and he finished 8th. He was 2nd on the stage to Alpe d'Huez. Taco van der Hoorn was very close to winning the cobbled stage, wasn't he? He was 2nd there, probably pretty disappointed. And all 8 riders have finished. But they didn't really perform the function of kind of breakaway specialists that maybe we would have expected. They had a few people up the road, but I think they'll be pretty happy with that. No stage win, of course, but well, top 10 overall.
The stage is not finished, you never know. Alexander Kristoff, who already won on Champs-Élysées. If things go, according to plan, I mean, he's not a favourite, obviously, but who knows?
Who knows indeed? Well, the Cycling Podcast famously wrote Alexander Kristoff off years ago, and then he promptly won on the Champs-Élysées. This is our kind of impromptu, random end-of-tour report as we walk around the team buses. It's a tradition we started a few years ago, and in no particular order, really. It's just as we see the buses. Next up, Astana, who I think have had a really poor tour, even though Alexei Lutsenko has crept into the top 10 with 2 very good stages in the Pyrenees where he finished 5th and 6th, and he's going to end 9th, but really almost anonymous apart from that. They lost Gianni Moscon very early. They also lost Fabio Fellini, who might have been an outsider for some reasonable results in sprints, but a poor tour for Astana, I think.
Yeah, I really couldn't tell you who was in the team, I have a list of starters in my pocket, throughout the Tour de France, and you go looking through the list, for riders who could make an impression on one day if you make a little bit of a prediction. And to be honest, apart from Lutsenko, I mean, it's been a very, very poor tour for Astana. Well, compared to their past record on Grand Tours and on the Tour itself. Lutsenko started a little bit ill, apparently, and he gathered form as the Tour went on. Well done for him. He's a top 10 finisher, but not much to say about Astana.
No, Simone Velasco, 31st overall, best Italian in the race. I mean, that says more about Italian cycling, perhaps, than it does about Astana, even. But let's go round the corner and see who we see next.
The Cycling Podcast at the 2022 Tour de France, powered by Super Sapien. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Still guessing on fueling? Not sure what or when to eat and drink on rides that matter? Never again. Optimize your fueling strategy with real-time glucose data, actionable insight, and personalized analytics. We are here to help you achieve your performance goals. Go to supersapiens.com for more on how to track your energy levels and fuel for success.
Thank you very much to Super Sapiens. They've seen us through the 2022 edition of the Tour de France. They're our title sponsors, of course, and they have a system of continuous glucose monitoring which you can wear to see how your body responds to fueling, exercise and sleep, and as a result of the readings you can tailor the way you prepare for your training and racing. Now, Super Sapiens is for everyone, but glucose monitoring is a really important fact of life for type 1 diabetics. And the Novo Nordisk team, funnily enough, Novo Nordisk, a Danish company based in Copenhagen, I think, all of their riders are type 1 diabetics. And last year, a film crew followed the team all season, and the film Ride for Your Life is available to watch on Outside Online now. And this is a little teaser, a little trailer from that film.
An issue for these guys is to calculate how many units they have to inject.
If during the race your sugar is high and you haven't been able to eat anything, you come to the car and we make corrections in terms of one unit.
You have something to test the sugar or no?
Just needle, it's okay.
How much? 78, it says.
Everybody's just going outside of their skin riding to demonstrate what's possible with our condition. And there's no better way to do that than getting great results.
Go to Outside Online and look up the film Ride for Your Life if you want to watch the Novo Nordisk documentary, and go to supersapiens.com to find out more about Super Sapiens. Arkea Samsic then, Francois, one of the French teams, would have had high hopes for Warren Barguil, but he pulled out of the race with COVID. But Nairo Quintana, sixth overall, and looking really good on the Col du Granon stage where he was second, was punished for holding on to one of the motorbikes and had a time penalty in the Pyrenees. But finishes sixth overall, a couple of top tens for Capio and Hofstetter. What do you make of Arkea Samsic?
I think they did the tour they needed to, you know, to have. I mean, probably they were, you know, hoping for a better result for Quintana, top five maybe, but it's not far from that. He showed he still has, you know, has it. I mean, he's now almost an old timer compared to the young, you know, up and coming riders. But you know, top six is a pretty good result. And as you said, you know, Capio and especially Hofstetter, who is the was regular in ninth place. I mean, he's always almost always between 8 and 10. Maybe one day there'll be a crash or something. I mean, I'm not that I'm hoping for it. And Hofstetter will have his day, but very consistent towards, you know, between 8th and 10th. Well, what can I say? It's a little bit, you know, maybe he'll turn one day into a great lead out man. Obviously he doesn't have the strength, the speed, the kick required to shine at the Grand Tour level. But yeah, generally I think that Arkea Samsic got what they had come for.
It strikes me that we should be awarding some kind of number of stars out of 5 or 10 or something. I know Daniel Freeb's patented, copyrighted system of rating the entertainment factor of the Tour de France with wine glasses out of 5. We can't use wine glasses. I think in the past we've used bidons. I was going to suggest maybe face masks for the teams that got through with the fewest COVID cases, but maybe that's a little bit poor taste. Quickstepper just over there, Francois, and I mean, they had an absolutely fantastic opening weekend. Yves Lampaert won the time trial in Copenhagen, probably against the odds, really, and then Fabio Jakobsen backed that up the next day. So they had the yellow jersey, Jakobsen had the stage win, but since then it's not gone all that brilliantly, has it? They lost Askren and Mikkel Merku heroically outside the time limit by more than an hour, Merku, and it's been a struggle for Jakobsen in the mountains. We are of course talking before the sprint finish on the Champs-Élysées today, as the break just goes past us over there. I suppose looking back, and the decision to leave out Mark Cavendish, which was the big talking point at the start, Patrick Lefevre will feel that he got it right because Jakobsen got a stage win, and it's not as if there were multiple opportunities for the sprinters, really.
No, I don't think Mark Cavendish would have won more stages than Fabio Jakobsen, and if you know it, and he would have struggled as much as Jakobsen did in the mountain, and the same guys, you know, Florian Senechal, Yves Lampaert would have had to do the same job of, you know, trying to make him past the mountains, and he would be today looking for a sprint win on the Champs-Élysées, which is very doubtful. If you don't have Asgreen, you know, to lead the lead out in a way, and Michael Murko to finish the job before you launch your sprint, it's going to be very it would have been very difficult for Cavendish, and I suppose it would be very difficult for Fabio Jakobsen. I mean, we, you know, stage is not finished, so maybe I'll be proved wrong.
Israel Premier Tech are right in front of us, and I think you'd have to say they've had a brilliant tour with two stage wins, Simon Clark winning on the cobbles and then Hugo Uhl winning in the Pyrenees at Foix. They've lost Mike Woods today, another victim of COVID, so Mike Woods, the Canadian, doesn't finish the tour. Chris Froome also out with COVID, as was Clark. I suppose we saw flashes of the old Chris Froome on Alpe d'Huez. He might have been both heartened and also a little kind of disappointed by that, because he didn't have what was required to keep up with the young whippersnapper Tom Pidcock. But two stage wins, 24th overall for Hugo Uhl. They weren't really in the GC race, but I would imagine they'll be very happy with that.
Yeah, a much better tour, I suppose, than they expected. They had Jakob Fuglsang, their leader, at the start of the Tour de France, and well, he was really below par and finally pulled out, as many others in the team. So, you know, the wins came from where you didn't expect them to come. Simon Clark nearly put an end to his career, you know, last season, and finally went on for one season with Israel Premier Tech to win one of the most important stages of this Tour de France. And Hugo Uhl, well, we told the story, the perfect teammate, the hardworking, nice guy, finally getting his day, to win a stage in the Pyrenees on top of it. And you mentioned Chris Froome as well. I really don't think they expected that much, especially as they had never won a Grand Tour stage before.
What about Trek Segafredo then? Because they got a stage win with Mads Pedersen in Saint Etienne. He was also third back in Denmark and in Carcassonne. Bauke Mollema, a fairly quiet tour, got in a few breaks, finished 25th overall. Had a very good time trial yesterday, and well in the top 10 there for Mollema. But given the kind of the horsepower they've got in the team, I don't think they didn't really get themselves into winning positions as often as perhaps they might.
Yeah, no, a bit disappointed by Trek Segafredo. They obviously came on this Tour de France for stage wins, like Sunweb now, DSM used to do in the past. And apart from Mads Pedersen, who had a brilliant win, the rest was Jasper Stuyven was in a few breakaways as well. But by and large, as you said, Bauke Mollema a little bit under par. He read apparently the 7 or 8 books he had taken with him on the tour. Well, maybe he should have read a little bit less, and I like Mollema as a rider. I'm a little bit disappointed. We really thought on some of the so-called transitional stages, the hardest ones. I mean, he was almost never in the breaks that mattered, which is not like him. So yeah, an overall pretty disappointing, in spite of Mads Pedersen win.
Yeah, Giulio Ciccone got in breaks but never got into the front portion of those breaks when it really mattered. Jasper Stuyven was always chasing on the cobbles. Well, that would have been a great day for him. Quinn Simmons was prominent a couple of days, but was completely blown off Wout van Aert's wheel on the stage to Longwy, if you remember. So I'd say one stage win is just about getting over the minimum bar for Trek Segafredo, I think, given the lineup. We can see Lotto Soudal there, and without being unkind, it's been a really, really tough tour for them. I mean, Tim Wellens they lost with COVID, 7 finishers, Andreas Kron, 70th overall, their best rider, and his 4th place at Lausanne, their best stage result. And Caleb Ewan has been really out of sorts right from the start. I think, he's had just 2 top 10s. His best result was 9th at Sonneborg back in Denmark. And Philippe Gilbert given a kind of sentimental farewell to the Tour de France, but really got off the front once, I can remember. Maybe he did again, I can't recall, but a sentimental final appearance for Gilbert, and a so far a very deflating tour for Lotto Soudal.
Very strange. You could tell from the lineup, at the start that this was a team that seemed to have no plan. I mean, all the plan was for Caleb Ewan, but I mean, it didn't work. I'm a great fan of Tim Wellens, one of my favorite riders, but he always underperforms in the Tour de France. He has a problem with allergies in July. He's never in his best shape. It's a little bit of a shame. And without his friend Thomas de Gent at the start, I mean, he looked out of sorts. So yeah, I mean, Brent Van Moor, who's usually a great breakaway rider, was never seen in any breaks. Andreas Kren was the one, as you said, who performed a little bit. He was on the break. He wasn't one of the breaks that could have gone all the way, and he crashed. He went out of the road when he was going for the win. Yes, I mean, I guess the morale of the team was badly hurt by Caleb Ewan's form through all this tour. He might win again on the Champs-Élysées today. Once again, we don't know, but serious doubts about him as well.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour at the Tour de France, to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Babbel, which is an app to help you learn a new language. Now, my French gets me by in hotels and restaurants, but I've been adding to my basic understanding with the Babbel app, because the lessons are effective, they're short, they take about 15 minutes, and they give you language that you can use in practical situations. Babbel's lessons are created by over 150 language experts. That means real people, so you're not learning AI phrases that don't mean anything. You can choose from 14 different languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, and German, and Babbel's speech recognition technology helps you to improve your pronunciation and accent. There are many ways to learn with Babbel, because in addition to the app, you can use the podcast, play the games, watch the videos, or even join in live classes with a language teacher. So start your new language learning journey with Babbel today. Right now, Babbel is offering our listeners 6 months free with a purchase of a 6-month subscription. Use the promo code cycling. Go to babbel.com/play and use the promo code cycling for an extra 6 months free when you sign up for a 6-month subscription. That's babbel.com/play, promo code cycling. Babbel, language learning that works. Well, Francois, 45 kilometres to go, and just a 4-man break hovering off the front. Benoit Cosnefroy of AG2R, Niels Pollitt of Bora Hansgrohe, Chris Nylund of Israel Premier Tech, and Pierre Latour of Total Energies. Now, I don't want to kind of beat up on Total Energies unnecessarily, but you have to wonder, what are they making of this? Because a lot of money has gone into this team. A lot of money has gone to Peter Sagan. We know he's had trouble. He's not the rider of yesterday. He's had COVID a few times, but really anonymous in the Tour. A fourth place at Carcassonne, a fourth place back in Denmark at Sonneborg. Edvald Bosenhagen got into the move on the cobbled stage and looked for a moment like he might win it, but ended up finishing third. Pierre Latour, I mean, 59th overall. We've seen better from him before. They lost Daniel Oss in the crash on the cobbles. They lost Alexis
Viermo.
Well done. Excellent pronunciation, Francois. But, I mean, pound for pound, given that they've got more strings to their bow, perhaps, than Lotto Soudal, who, you know, have Caleb Ewan as their kind of obvious team leader, really, Total Energies haven't delivered anything, have they?
No, I talked to Jean-René Bernardeau, their manager, and in L'Alpe d'Huez, and already he knew, he was that tour was not going to be great. I mean, he mentioned health issues from most of them. Pierre Latour was not great. Peter Sagan was not in shape, and as you said, Daniel Oss crashed. I mean, so there was not great hopes actually for Alexis Villarmeau at this strange skin problem as well. I mean, there were not great hopes. Halfway through the tour, they knew that, it would be very difficult to feature either in the GC, where probably Latour was the only hope, and for a stage win. So, It's in a way it's a makeshift team, TotalEnergies, with old riders like Edvald Boisson-Hagen or Peter Sagan, who have been probably hired for the points as much as for anything else, and it shows on the road. I mean, you know, there's no coherence, and I'm not doubting there is a team spirit there, but you know, that's obviously not a clear plan on what they're trying to do. So yeah, not a great tour. We'll see for the future, you know, because some signings are announced in that team. We'll see. We'll see where they go.
We can just see Movistar there, and well, Enric Mas, who's been on the podium in Grand Tours before, below par for him, and then positive for COVID before stage 19, having sort of hauled himself into the top 10 but never really looking that convincing. The best he looked probably was at La Planche des Belles Filles, but he never really kicked on from there. Matteo Jorgensen probably had the most eye-catching day when he was chasing Hugo Uhl and crashed on the descent into Foix. He finished 21st overall, finished 4th in that stage. He also finished 4th at Megève. And Carlos Verona, 3rd place at Châtel, was Movistar's best result. And an interesting story today, because Gorka Izagirre has pulled out of the Tour in order to go home, not ride the final stage. He's gone home in order to ride the Villafranca Ordizia one-day race in the Basque Country, which is basically his home race tomorrow. So skipping the final stage in Paris in order to race back in the Basque Country maybe says it all about Movistar's Tour.
Yeah, well, obviously, you know, losing Alejandro Valverde and all the you know, the stars, Spanish stars they had in the past was a problem. Enric Mas, obviously, you know, affected by COVID. Or my impression was when he pulled out with COVID was that, you know, maybe COVID was an excuse for fading. But I mean, no, I'm nasty. Wow. I've been nasty there. But no, a little bit disappointing, because Enric Mas has been really riding a la Zubeldia for many, many seasons now, finishing in top 5, top 6, you know, in Grand Tours without winning anything. Best impression, Matteo Jorgensen, with Fred Wright, the two young and up-and-coming riders who really tried to be in the break, took risks. I mean, Matteo Jorgensen took so many risks that he crashed pretty badly as he was in a break, you know, in the road to Foix. But that's the way you learn, that's the way you'll go forward. We know that Jorgensen is a great, you know, hope. And, he did what he had to do as a up-and-coming rider in the Tour de France. And so, well, we'll see what the future holds for him.
Just there is Bike Exchange. I would say they had an excellent tour, winning a couple of stages. Dylan Groenewegen back in Denmark, of course. And then Michael Matthews won at Mond, having been second to Van Aert at Lausanne and second to Tadej Pogacar at Longwy. I mean, beaten by the two of the best riders in the race into second place, but he pulled off his win at Mond. I mean, it was an absolutely stellar performance. That finish at Mond is difficult. He was up there with some really, really good climbers. A sort of classic racer's win, that. Nick Schultz, who's their best rider overall in 23rd, was second to Magnus Cort at Megève. Very close for the Australian there, but I would say, having come hunting for stages, to go home with two different riders, that's got to be a success. What would we give that? We'd probably give that 7 or 8 cans of Australian lager out of 10.
Yeah, I think that's deserved. Especially the Matthews win was really emphatic. I mean, he hadn't won on the tour for 5 years, and the way he did it, you know, like not in the style that we expect from him, with really authority, strength, consistency, and willpower, was really nice and refreshing to see. As you said, well, like Groenewegen, you had the impression they both had something to prove on this Tour de France, to get back to their best level. I think they can be satisfied. Once again, as you say, Nick Schultz, well, you know, always there when it mattered, in given his, you know, he's not one of the top GC contenders, but I mean, he did his job, and by and large, I think a very good performance by the team.
And just over there is the B&B Hotels bus. It's trying to hide, but I can see it. A little bit anonymous, B&B Hotels, although all 8 of their riders on course to finish the tour but really to no great effect. Sebastian Schoenberger, 35th overall, their best rider overall. Okay, they're not a team with any real GC hope, but their only result to speak of, Luca Mazzato, who was 6th in Calais, Alexis Gougère got into some good breaks, but wasn't going to win anything. I suppose the best you can say is that Jeremy Lecroq led the whole Tour de France for a while because he was the first man down the start ramp in the time trial in Copenhagen way back at the start.
Very, very little to say for B&B Hotels, to be honest.
Let's move on then.
Yeah.
Well, while we walk round to the other side of the team bus paddock, let's hear the impressions of two people who really brought the Cycling Podcast Tour coverage to life this year. Mitch Docker, who joined Francois and I for the first week of the race, and then Ian Boswell, who was with Francois, although I did jump back in at the end of the second week. This is Mitch and Ian on their thoughts of the 2022 Tour.
Well, it's freezing cold weather here back in Melbourne. I'm just about to head out for a ride, and Lionel asked me, what was my best memory from this year's Tour de France? Well, first of all, look, I've got a few good things. First of all, starting in Denmark, back with the Cycling Podcast crew, it really felt great, and it was sort of heightened by that atmosphere in Denmark. Copenhagen was incredible. I love getting back in the car with Lionel and also Francois back in the nest. It really brought back great memories of my time last year there with Francois and Richard. So I was like, wow, this is going to be great. Once we got then to France, of course, the highlight, it's got to be everyone's highlight. It's the Roubaix stage. How good was that? The whole stage was great, but I loved running around with Lionel. It felt like being back on the race. The energy I got from the riders, but also the energy from the crowd and that pressure to get to the next cobblestone sector, to get to the finish. I sort of like that adrenaline rush. And I guess probably the last thing I really enjoyed was when, you know, Lionel gave me the keys to the city and, you know, Francois and I took over the podcast for a couple of days. I did feel the pressure and I started to understand how hard the job really is of producing that podcast. So I was honored. You know, I was honored that he saw me fit in that position and, you know, went for it. I don't know what the listeners thought, but anyway, I had a really good time for the first 10 days on the Tour de France with the crew.
Hey, Francois and Lionel, hope you've been enjoying the last week of the Tour de France together. I sure do miss you guys. I had a great time. And as the race finishes in Paris today, I've been doing a little bit of reflecting on my favorite moment of this year's Tour. And surprisingly, I'm going to go all the way back to stage 4 when Wout van Aert won in Calais. I think that stage in particular, you know, we'd had 3 pretty uneventful days up in Denmark, not the most exciting racing. And then when the race got to France and the way in which Wout van Aert won that stage, I think really set a precedent for this new age and this new era of racing. And I think we continue to see riders maybe taking inspiration from how Wout won that stage into how they were going to go about trying to win their own stage or get their own result at this year's Tour. It's something completely different to the times that I participated in Grand Tours with Team Sky, where things were very controlled, very calculated, very predictable. I think this year we saw competitive, you know, and unpredictable racing in just about every single stage. And I think that a lot of that could have been dictated by the way in which Wout van Aert won stage 4. Clearly, he is a phenomenal athlete himself, and not many people could have made that effort that he did, but I think it did inspire other athletes to maybe think about racing slightly differently than they have raced in the past. My favorite memory of when I was at the race, it's nearly impossible to pick out one. I think what I enjoyed most was just being back in that heavily dense cycling world. You know, oftentimes I don't get to speak a lot about cycling here at home. Well, I get to speak about cycling, but I don't necessarily have people to speak to it about. And I think I just really enjoyed being back in the Tour bubble and analyzing riders and, you know, tactics and strategy and, you know, the upcoming stage. I really enjoyed that, being immersed in the race once again, you know, almost to the same degree, if maybe not even more so than when I was a rider, because then there's so many factors that how you're feeling and, you know, what your role with the team is. But to kind of, you know, sit around at the dinner table or in the car and speculate and have discussions with Ed and Francois, about the upcoming days and see how our thoughts kind of transferred into how the race played out. I really enjoyed that, and I hope I get to come back for some point or some race down the road with the cycling podcast. It has been a phenomenal 3 weeks of racing, and Francois, I hope this isn't your last tour, but at the same time, having just covered a week of it, I know that 4 weeks on the road is a big ask, but you have done a fantastic job, and it was a pleasure to learn from you. And Lionel, thank you so much for having me and for sharing a cassoulet with me in Carcassonne, and I hope to catch up with all of you guys very soon. Ciao.
Well, into the final 20 kilometers now, Francois, and what's that? Five riders up the road. Not by very much. It's only 15 seconds. Two from Groupama FDJ, Duchesne and Le Gac. Two from EF Education, Owain Doul and Jonas Rutsch, and Max Schachmann from Bora Hansgrohe. Well, let's talk about EF, shall we? Because I think they've had an absolutely stellar tour, haven't they?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it was not won at first. I mean, the main GC, you know, leader was Rigoberto Urán, and it was below par. Let's face it. So you might have thought that the tour would be a failure, but I mean, they had, of course, Magnus Cort, who from day one in Copenhagen, Chile's Silly was forced out of the tour with COVID, was really the man of the he made the show. He won a stage in Megève. He was really the man who made the beginning of the tour interesting, fascinating, fun. Nilsson Paulus proved once again what a great future he has ahead of him as probably a GC contender if he managed to master his impulsions and gets to learn a little bit about the science of riding. Who else?
Well, I thought Alberto Bettiol was decent, finishing second at Mond. That was a real battle, wasn't it, between him and Michael Matthews. But I think, Nilsson Paulus, the way they got him up the road on the cobbled stage and got him to gain some time, I thought that was really smart riding. It backfired on them a little bit with the pictures of Bettiol kind of riding on the front, perhaps when he should have been sitting in the wheels a bit more. But I mean, I thought that was a little bit harsh, storming a teacup. Paulus was within an ace of the yellow jersey all day on the stage to Longwy, and had it not been for Pogacar winning the stage, maybe he would have been in yellow for a day or so. His challenge did fade a little bit and he slipped to 13th overall. But when you consider how badly it started on day one with Stefan Bissiger crashing twice in the time trial, I'd say that EF would be extremely happy with how their tour has gone. Groupama FDJ, I think, given the difficulties that Thibaut Pinot has had, they'll also be pretty happy with having managed to get David Gaudu up into fourth place overall, because that was a real team effort, wasn't it? Him and Valentin Madouas worked really hard for that position, and Gaudu then pulled out a very good time trial. All eight riders finishing here in Paris, two of them up the road at the moment. Perhaps could have expected a bit more from Michael Storer. A tough tour for him, but he was in some breaks here and there. But Marc Madiot will obviously rue the fact that they didn't quite manage to pull off a stage win. But I guess with the resources they had, getting a top five overall and a stage win, it might have been either or. So perhaps they'll be quite happy with Gaudu's overall finish.
Yeah, they built their team around David Gaudu. He was announced. Their goal at the start was a podium finish. They're not far from it. They're just at the foot of the podium with Gaudu, but I mean, obviously the three riders on ahead of Gaudu were untouchable, so for them to not only being the first Frenchman but the best result by that team since Thibaut Pinot were third on the in the tour in 2014, I think, is a great result. I mean, I'm sure Gaudu who maybe lacked a little bit of confidence and also lost a little bit of faith in himself when he saw guys of his generation or younger than him, like Pogacar, Vingegaard, or Egan Bernal, win Grand Tours. He probably, renewed trust in himself. And we'll see. It'll be interesting to see what he does next season. And of course, there was Thibaut Pinot. I think the hopes of a stage win lay probably on Thibaut Pinot's shoulders. There was a hope that he could, get into a break, which he tried to do twice, and go for a stage win. Unfortunately for him, he obviously didn't have the right legs to do that.
and Bora Hansgrohe, who also represented in this break as they approached 15 kilometres to go. Alexander Vlasov, who crashed at the start of the tour, didn't he? But he's come really strong in the final week and has moved himself up to fifth overall. I'd imagine he'd be very happy with that and perhaps wondering what might have been had he not had a few difficult days around the Alps. Leonard Kemner, who came within metres of winning at La Planche des Belles Filles, and also got himself up to second overall, just 11 seconds off the yellow jersey when he got in the break at Megève. A decent tour for Bora Hansgrohe, but compared to their Giro, well, they didn't shine quite as brightly. Obviously, the level is slightly different here. I guess they'll be satisfied, but perhaps not delighted.
Well, I suppose, you know, it always decided in the first week for Vlasov when he was not at his best. I think he crashed and he had health issues. And from then on, you know, for him to rebuild his shape and come back the way he did it in the third week is remarkable. I think he's worth probably even more than his final GC ranking. He was really one of the major outsiders at the start of this Tour de France. I really, really, really need to see Vlasov, you know, ride a Grand Tour from A to Z in his best shape.
And lastly, before we move on, Francois, Cofidis. Nothing to write home about when it comes to the GC. John Izaguirre in 42nd place overall, but Simon Geschke's had a very good tour, I think. Got into a lot of breaks, climbed very well. The kind of parsimonious allocation of King of the Mountains points really counted against him because he turned himself inside out to try and win that jersey and then was steamrolled at the end because Vingegaard, racing for the overall win, of course, gathered up the points. Now, I know they want to weight it so that the bigger mountains count more, but I feel like it was pretty harsh on Geschke to miss out on the jersey, having really targeted it, raced well for it, and just been undone right at the death.
No, he's a great rider. He's been for a long time very consistent and deserved that at long last. To, I mean, he was rewarded with stage wins in the past, but yeah, I mean, this would have crowned in a way a great career as, you know, consistent, solid all-rounder. Well, unfortunately for him, you know, Vingegaard was a little bit too strong. They came for the GC, I think, with Guillaume Martin, who was one of the first riders sent home with COVID, and then they had to change their plans, and that's when the polka dot came into view. Maybe a small little hint at Benjamin Thomas, who's who's a very strong time trial specialist and comes from the track and was riding his first tour and was often there in the finales of the stages as a couple of top 10 finishes and was a very consistent and probably a rider to watch in the future.
Well, we'll wrap up the rest of the teams a little bit later on, but there has been another race on the Champs-Élysées this afternoon, and that was stage one of the Tour de France Femmes. And we're going to catch up with Rose Manley, who will be hosting daily coverage of the Tour de France Femmes for the cycling podcast Féminin this coming week, and find out what the atmosphere was like this afternoon. And crucially, who won the stage and is wearing the first yellow jersey in the history of the race.
You are listening to the cycling podcast at the 2022 Tour de France Femmes. Powered by Super Sapiens, energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Stage 1, today within Paris.
I've come away from the team bus area to a little brasserie, I think it's called the Brasserie de Madeleine, a little walk away from the Place de la Concorde, and I'm delighted to be joined by Rose Manley. Hello, Rose.
Hello, Lionel. Well, this is where you'll always find me, in a brasserie with a beer. I've just been here the whole time that you guys have been working so hard at the tour, and I've just been waiting here for you guys to come and find me.
Just waiting for the baton or the microphone to be handed over, because you're here, of course, for the Tour de France Femmes, which started here in Paris this afternoon and continues through to next Sunday to La Super Planche de Belles Filles. And you're going to be leading our coverage, daily coverage of the Tour de France Femmes, kicks off tomorrow. And, well, you were out on the course, weren't you? But while we're here face-to-face, I can also thank you in person for last week anchoring our coverage so brilliantly with Francois and Ian out in France, held it all together, kept them in check. Thank you very much for that. So really looking forward to hearing the coverage this coming week. but you were out watching the race this afternoon on the Champs-Élysées. So this is your summary of stage one of the Tour de France fam.
La réalité, c'est aujourd'hui, et dans quelques secondes, mesdames et messieurs, nous allons écouter l'hymne national de la France, la Marseillaise.
Riders are on the Champs-Élysées now, and attacks coming thick and fast. It looks like EF very keen to get a break to stick here on the Champs-Élysées. You might be able to hear the helicopters going on above. All of the cars are just going through now, all the team cars ready to help if anything happens. Of course, this is nothing new for the riders of this peloton. They've been on Champs-Élysées before, most notably Le Course 2014, 2015, 2016. They had a one-day race here, the kind of precursor to what is now the Tour de France fam that we have. So for a lot of these riders, there won't be anything new riding on the Champs-Élysées, but there's so much more at stake here. Getting to wear the yellow jersey, getting to be part of a stage race under the Tour de France umbrella. I'm going to head up to the finish line, where a little bit further from the crowds, and see what we can see there. 600 metres to go. You can see Jumbo Visma at the front. They're going to be working so hard for Marianne Vos. If she can pull it off, it would be a magical start to the Tour de France fam, and such a historic day. And we can see they're building up to the big sprint. We can see them coming towards us, one huge block towards the line. All the riders across the road now, coming in across the line. And it's Lorena Wiebes of Team DSM who comes across, and they are steaming through. They're coming, here they come, here come the peloton, here they come. Lorena Wiebes now, she's just got pulled off of her bike. She's sitting on the floor, she's trying to take it all in. Teammates are now crowding around her, shaking her hand, giving her high fives, patting her on the back. Lorena Wiebes there being congratulated by everyone. She looks overcome with emotion. Her parents are there, hugging them. Hey! That was Annemiek van Vleuten. Yeah, well, there's a lot of chaos here at the finish line on the Champs-Élysées. There's still, it's been many, many minutes now since the race finished, and there are riders still everywhere. There's a rider, unfortunately, from the Saint-Michel team who looks like that she's really struggling. She's lying out on the floor. She's trying to get some fluids in, try and get some food. It's kind of a bit of a stark contrast, because you can hear in the background the podium is warming up, and we'll be seeing, of course, the presentation of the first yellow jersey of the Tour de France fam ever. And you can hear that getting ready over here. Of course, we're waiting now for Lorena Wiebes to come and take the first ever yellow jersey of the Tour de France fam. Really special moment for her. I mean, she is undoubtedly the best sprinter. I mean, it might have been more of a beautiful moment, of course, if Marianne Vos, who's the greatest cyclist of all time, if she had managed to take it. But there's no doubt that Lorena Wiebes is the strongest sprinter out there at the moment. And so it's only appropriate, knowing this arena of sprinting that is the Champs-Élysées, that it would be her that would take the yellow jersey here today. Victoire d'étape et première place au classement général, Lorena Wiebes.
Bonus. Voilà, félicité par l'hôtel SNCL en présence de Jeannie Longo, lauréate du Tour de France féminin 87, 88, 89, et Marianne Martin, lauréate du Tour de France féminin 1984.
See here now, Lorena Wiebes putting on the first yellow jersey of the Tour de France firm. She's got a little baby on stage with her. A little baby and a lion, which is almost the same size as the baby, I would say.
Pour ce beau tableau d'honneur de la leader au classement général.
Baby's not enjoying it as much as she is. Big smile on her face.
And
you see, she's not someone who's normally gets wrapped up in too much emotion, Lorena, but she looks pretty emotional right now.
Marianne Martin, qui avait été la première lauréate du Tour de France féminin en 1984.
Rose, there is a sense of history being made, even though this isn't the first women's Tour de France, as we know. But it's not so long ago, only a few years ago, that would have been your lot with La Course. And now the Tour de France fam carries on. Probably a sprint stage tomorrow. There's a gravel stage. There's La Planche de Belfi. It's a proper stage race. And it's off and running and underway.
Yeah, it's so varied, the route that we've got, which is great. And hopefully it lends itself to a lot of aggressive racing and hopefully seeing some new names also coming to the fore. But yeah, it was great to be back on the Champs-Élysées. But as you said, Lionel, that was the place in 2014, 2015, 2016. La Course was just, I can't remember how many laps it was of Champs-Élysées, but it seemed to go on forever, I have to admit. But it's interesting seeing some of those riders will have done that La Course now being on the Champs-Élysées this time. Interesting to see. I remember at La Course there were so many riders that would abandon, obviously because it's a one-day race. So if you're nowhere near the front, you may as well just quit. Obviously, I'm not a pro rider, so that's why I'm not a pro rider, that kind of attitude, probably, or a DS. But yeah, it was so interesting that there was more to fight for here today, and I really think that you know, kind of got that impression that there was also a yellow jersey on the line, which I think was a huge motivating factor for a lot of the riders that were out there as well.
Were you surprised by the identity of the winner, Lorena Wiebes? Because, I mean, I wasn't. She was kind of the pre-race favourite. She is probably the best sprinter in the world. Elisa Balsamo may have a word to say about that, and we might see later on in the week. But to see Wiebes and Marianne Vos, who is basically the kind of iconic figure of women's cycling, shoulder to shoulder on the Champs-Élysées, off to a great start.
No, I think it's kind of fitting in a way. That Lorena Wiebes won, because she is, without doubt, I would say. I'm not even sure that Elisa Balsamo would even say that you know, she wasn't the absolute best, most dominant sprinter in the peloton at the moment. I mean, she just wins everything and wins it by quite some margin. I would have loved to have seen Marianne Vos win it. I think it would have been, you know, she's the greatest cyclist of all time, and it would have been a real magical moment for her to have won it. And she actually won the first La Course that we had here on the Champs-Élysées. But in a way, it is fitting for Lorena Wiebes to win it. You know, Champs-Élysées is a great arena for, you know, the greatest sprinters. All the best sprinters in the world on the male side have won here. So it's kind of fitting that she would win, even if... Yeah, she's not the most emotive of riders. I think that's maybe why she's not necessarily a fan favourite, but she's just one of those incredible athletes. But yeah, shall we hear from her? We're going to hear now from Pfeiffer Georgie, who is her teammate, who was involved in a lot of the run-up to that sprint. And he's also her roommate, in fact. And then we'll hear a little bit from the winner and the holder of the yellow jersey, Lorena Wiebes, who I caught up with when she was in the mix zone. Well, Pfeiffer, how was it out there today?
Yeah, hard and hot, but yeah, pretty special actually. I think, yeah, the first stage of the first Tour de France Femme, starting with the backdrop of signing on with the Eiffel Tower, I think you can't get much better than that really. And yeah, doing the iconic Champs-Élysées, we watch the men do it every year, and to start our tour here, I think, just everyone came to the line with a real buzz, and we were completely motivated to make it a sprint for Lorena, because she's obviously so strong, and if we deliver her at the right time, we have the full confidence that she can pull it off. And to get the first yellow jersey, I think that's something really special.
And because Lorena wins an awful lot, so does this feel so much more special? Is it more elevated than the other wins that she gets?
yeah, I think just this event is pretty monumental in itself, and I think, yeah, today I guess we wrote a piece of history, so for sure we're going to enjoy this one. I think it was, yeah, it was completely a team effort with the girls controlling moves and then delivering a lead out in, yeah, a pretty hectic finish. So yeah, I think this one definitely feels, yeah, special, and we're going to enjoy it.
And I mean, how focused was Lorena coming into this? Because she, I mean, she is, I think it's quite, you know, you can't even debate whether she's the best sprinter in the world or not, because she just is. So, you know, did she feel a lot of pressure coming into this?
Well, so I'm her roommate at the moment, and surprisingly she was very calm, and I think that's just who she is, really. She, it, what, whether she feels the pressure, I don't know. She for sure doesn't show it. I think, yeah, she knows what to do, and yeah, she has our full support, and yeah, all the girls are committed, so I think we just go in with a plan and, yeah, deliver it as we can. So I think in that sense, she kind of doesn't take in too much of the external pressure. Maybe it comes from herself more. But yeah, it was, went perfectly in the end, actually.
And this must be great for the rest of the week, because there are a few more flat stages to come. You must take a lot of confidence from it.
Yeah, definitely. I think, yeah, coming into the tour, our goals are the Lorena for the sprint stages and Julia for the GC, so I think, yeah, we're fully committed behind those two goals, and the different days we'll have our, yeah, different tasks, and yeah, I think the whole team's in really good shape, so I think there's a lot of confidence, yeah, from us.
So now you're going to be sharing the room with the yellow jersey?
Yeah, pretty special, isn't it?
Are you going to try it on, Fiver?
No. We'll find a nice place for it on the table.
Great, thanks very much.
Thank you.
It's really nice. I'm really enjoying it, and yeah, it's a really special feeling. It was a goal from the beginning of the season already, and we worked hard for it. Everyone of the team worked hard for it. Not only the people who are here, but also at surface course in Deventer, everyone did their job, and we can really proud of this. Well, first I'm gonna enjoy tomorrow, but also we will go for the stage victory again. And for the rest of the week, we will aim for Juliet or CC. And if it's not too much effort, we will go for the green jersey.
There was a really symbolic moment on the podium, wasn't there? Because the yellow jersey was presented to Lorena Weber by Marianne Martin, who won the Tour Féminin, the first Tour de France for women, back in 1984. Invited here by the organisers. And it does feel like the sort of whole thing has come full circle. I think it was really nice that they invited Marianne Martin over to present the jersey, and just acknowledge that this is a continuation of something that has been here in the past. And you know, a Tour de France for women is back on the calendar, and they're ready to go.
Yeah, it'll be exciting to see how this race evolves. I actually caught up with at the start line, saw this little group of ladies in all matching yellow T-shirts. All of them said the originals on there. I thought, I wonder if they might be the original cyclists who did the Tour de France back in the day, back in the 80s. And they were. A whole group, well, you'll hear from them now, a whole group of different riders who did different dates from different countries, but they came together to enjoy this special moment.
Someone's from the UK, and then we've got America, and we've all got on Germany. She's somewhere in it. There she is from Germany, and we've all met up here to see the women's tour off. So we decided T-shirts would be nice for us to stand out and sort of make an impression that there was a tour in the 80s, and most of us, between us, I think we've covered every tour that ran in the 80s.
So I'm going to go around this wonderful group, and if you can all give me your name and which year you rode.
Sue Gornall, I rode from 86 to 89.
Mel Gravel, 87 to 89.
Hi, Judith Painter, 84, 85, 86 and 88.
Claire Greenwood, 1984 to 1993.
Linda Gornall, 1985 and 1989.
Louise Garber, 84.
Trish Liggett, manager masseur, from 84 to 89, whatever it was.
Mandy Jones, 1985.
Susan Elias, 86, 87, 89.
Ines Hahnkamp, Germany, 86 and 87.
Nan Dierdorf McLean, I did it in 1987.
Well, so how do we? What was the best result that we had among you all? Who's
Louise?
White jersey.
White jersey.
Riders. Yeah.
Catherine was second on the tour.
She was.
Yeah,
second place. Catherine Swinnerton was second on the Champs-Élysées in the sprint, so she was the best place individual on a stage, I think.
What did you do, Susan?
89, fourth overall, blue jersey.
Wow.
Right, so how different is this race today than the race when it was back then?
They have buses. We were crammed into station wagons, for one thing.
Yeah. Ice vests. They have ice vests. I don't remember ever getting an ice vest.
So tell us, what was it like when you were coming to the Tour de France Féminin back in the day? What was your kind of like the preparation, or what, you know, imagine you had to make your own way there, or how was it?
Well, the year I did it, we were pretty well taken care of, actually. I didn't have to pay for anything. But yeah, I think that was different the first year. For a lot of riders, it meant going into debt.
Oh, wow.
We were amateurs. We all had to go back to work and provide all our own equipment and everything to even come. So as soon as we got back, we were straight back to work to the day job. So it's brilliant how it's come on, yeah.
How the preparation was before the tour?
Yeah.
Oh, in Germany it was like that we went, that we traveled around the world from February until October. And it started with the tour of Texas, then Tour de Lourdes, then Pass Giro in Norway, then Colorado Rundfahrt sometimes, and then the Tour de France. So we doesn't have to train a lot.
And how big was the Tour de France back then? Was it much bigger than the other races, or was it still kind of just like any other race?
It was the biggest race we did, and it was the first tour stage race, a big, long stage race. But we were amateur women as well, and we weren't allowed to ride long. The distances they do now are much longer than we were allowed to ride. So the other thing they did was they split the race into two parts and made it, because again, the rules were we were not allowed to ride a stage race. Was it over 10 days originally? Yeah, we had to have a rest day to split it up. So, yeah.
Wow. But I mean, but a 10-day stage is still more, that 10-day race is still more than they're doing this time around.
No, we ended up doing 18 days.
Yeah, we had 18 days.
We did the virtual tour.
Yeah.
We did all 3 weeks.
And we finished at the same place as the men did, but we just started nearer the finishes.
Yeah.
And we had more rest days. Because they were professional men and we were amateur women, and we just weren't allowed to do... Not that we would want to ride 290 kilometres, I don't think, in one go.
Unnecessary.
No.
Unnecessary.
But, you know, massively different, yeah. So this is a start for the women that they're doing an eight-day stage, yeah. Yeah, it's good.
So someone was saying that the 1984 one was exactly the same as this.
Yeah, we followed the end part of their route and covered the same stages. And most of all, we were with the crowd, so it was just amazing, the atmosphere. It must have been good for the crowds as well to see the women race as well as the men.
Yeah. But how was that? I mean, that must have been...
That's what got you round. The crowd lifted you. It's the only reason you kept going half the time. You just wouldn't have, and they pushed you and cheered for you and everything. It was fantastic.
And what do you hope for this race, for the future of this?
That it grows to a longer race and it get the support that it need, you know, that it deserves, really. Especially the sponsorship and the TV coverage, which will then bring in more sponsorship, which will help it build.
Do you guys, you know, wish that you had this back in your day, or kind of doing the longer race?
It had to grow. Like cycling had to grow. It had to grow from a grassroots. You couldn't have given us this at that time.
No, it would have been mind-blowing, impossible. It would have been a bit mind-blowing, I think, if we'd have had this, because we just weren't used to any...
It was too much of a jump in one go. It's taken time.
I really like those ice vests.
Marianne Martin was featured in an episode of Kilometre Zero about the 1984 Tour de France. Her story was phenomenal, really. I mean... It is kind of night and day, the difference. I mean, this is a huge peloton, really. 144 riders, I think, started. Two non-finishers today, one rider outside the time limit, and there was quite a nasty crash for the Cofidis rider, Alana Kastrik. So she's out of the race. But I think it was 36 riders started in 1984. So, I mean, 142 riders will line up tomorrow. It's a big peloton of women riders, because I mean, even the women's tour field is sometimes only in the sort of 80s or 90s, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a big field, and I have to say, it'll be interesting to see over the coming days
quite what the gap is between the top riders and the lower continental riders, because there are some teams that I've actually never come across in at a race. I know of their names, but I've never come across them. So it'll be very interesting to see how they fare. And I have to say, on the finish line, there was some riders from the continental team, Sam Michel, and she looked like she was really suffering. But you have to remember that some riders have not got the same level of nutrition, and a lot of the riders in the peloton will still be non-professional, will still have jobs that they have to contend with alongside their training. As much as the Tour de France Femmes is a great step, I think it is kind of clear that this isn't the professionalisation of women's cycling. It's nice to have a new race with a new name, but in many ways the race here today felt a lot the same to many of the other stage races. I think that's kind of an important thing, that we're not looking to have loads of eyes on this one race a year. It's important that this is the catalyst to people watching women's cycling across the year, although it's difficult because obviously the men's side of the peloton, that is the case. There's a lot of casual viewers who probably only watch the Tour de France, so it would be a real struggle to get the women's peloton to do something different, but hopefully that is what happens.
Yeah, it's another step on a journey, isn't it? I mean, and an important one. I mean, it will be really interesting to see. The top riders will obviously be completely used to the challenge in front of them. They've done the Giro before. The course here is challenging on some days. It's probably smart that they put La Planche de Belfie at the end rather than sort of in the middle of the race for the benefit of the kind of the bottom third of the peloton, maybe. But that's just because of the disparity between the top and the bottom, because the top is properly professional and the bottom of the peloton is not yet properly professional. And it's about bringing the bottom of the peloton up, and this is a really important step on that journey. So I think the focus will be on the front half of the race, and rightly so, and I think we're going to see a great race unfold over the next few days. But I'm actually interested to know from Francois, because you were here in the late 80s when the first incarnation of the Tour de France for women, the Tour Féminin, was being held, and of course it was held on the same day as the men's race earlier in the afternoon. You were working as a journalist, but how much was it on your radar back in sort of 86, 87, 88?
To be honest, I mean, we were really taken over by the men's tour, but you had stars, and that's what you need. I mean, for it, it's a bit of a mystery of history that the Tour Femme did not last, because everything was there. You had Jeannie Longo, Maria Canins, you mentioned Marion Martin, but then, it was the big battle between those two. And there was a very strong field of German riders, American riders at the time. It was a little bit tighter than it is today, but you had 20 to 30 really competitive female riders at the time on the road. And it's a pity in a way the men's Tour de France didn't last because of strictly financial and economic reasons, because everything was there, already. It was kind of I know it's not a nice word, but kind of a miscarriage, everything was there. You had the stars, you had the wheel, I'm sure there was the money, and there would have been a following on TV and everywhere had they gone on, but we were in the late 80s, the early 90s, there's always these. I mean, the mood in terms, it's not a matter of men and women, but the mood at the time was, profit. It was all about, things should be profitable, and there was no long-term view. And I think that Félix Lévitant, who was the man who actually, as the tour director at the time, imposed that, probably that long-term view that was lacking a little bit afterwards. And about the disparity in levels, I think that's great. That's the way the Tour de France was made, and that's the way, male professionalism went up. I mean, some girls are going to suffer a lot, but they're going to really have a will to train harder, to be even better the year after. Remember at the Olympics, what happened? I mean, we can have a break with a great surprise at the finish as well. We can have unknown riders all of a sudden trying their luck, and you'll have of course, you know, some riders getting dropped and suffering, and you know, and probably others, you know, with the will and, you know, kind of taken by the importance of the event, you know, really going, you know, over the limits, and it's massively important for the race of the level of women's cycling. So I'm really thrilled, you know. I've said repeatedly that this is my last Tour de France. I mean, at least for the 3 weeks. I wouldn't mind covering the Tour Femme in the future.
We'll hold you to that, Francois, next year. Rose, you'll be doing all the driving. Francois will be in the nest in the back in the car. That's just how it goes. Well, Francois, your attempt to subvert the map vote didn't work, I'm afraid. The results are in. You've been lobbying for Czech for 3 weeks, but Czech has not won the public vote. There were three designs that MAP came up with for our cycling podcast collaboration, and the winning design will go into production, and it is Dot, the design which is kind of redolent of the late 1980s. I initially preferred Fade, but I think it was very close when I saw the actual jerseys photographed on real people. They came to life, and so very happy that Dot has won and will go into production, and a little buffalo motif will be added somewhere. So I'm looking forward to seeing where the map designer Misha puts the buffalo logo. Bad luck, Francois.
Well, I suppose most of our listeners, you know, were teenagers and discovered the Tour de France in the late 80s, and that's a little bit of nostalgia. Hey, you know, come on, young, come on, the 60-year-olds, guys born in the 60s. You know, next time, well, just first of all, listen to the cycling podcast, and then next year or when another poll like this, votes like me.
Well, we're really looking forward to seeing the jersey in real life when it is produced, and it will go on sale a little bit later this year. Check out all of MAP's clothing at map.cc. That's MAAP.cc. We're delighted to be partnering with them this year. Now, just over there, Francois, UAE Team Emirates, who obviously came into the race with a very strong lineup, all stacked up behind Tadej Pogacar, who of course led the race. He had three stage wins, finished second overall after being cracked first on the Col de Granon by Jonas Vingegaard. Best young rider by some distance, held the white jersey from start to finish. But the team was really wiped out by COVID, wasn't it? George Bennett, Vigard Stekelengen, both out with COVID. Rafał Majka had COVID, but his symptoms weren't deemed serious enough. But then he had to pull out because he tore his muscle when his chains broke on the stage to Foix. Soler had a terrible day on the road to Foix as well and was outside the time limit, throwing up on the bike. And Mark Hirschi, he's been riding on empty really from the start. Pretty miraculous that he's made it through at all. Probably their strongest support rider was Brandon McNulty, who was absolutely incredible on the stage to Per Aygaard. But I don't know whether we can pinpoint the kind of the cracks in the team as being the thing that let Pogacar down. Really, what let Pogacar down was that Vingegaard attacked him hard and he didn't have the response needed when it was required.
He was just beaten by a better rider. And if we take the team results, I mean, three stage wins and Brandon McNulty confirming what we know about him, that he's also a rider for the future. I mean, he is also in the young, you know, rider competition, I think, in third place. And I mean, he showed, you know, when it mattered, that he you know, he can also be you know, great prospect for the future. So as an overall team performance, of course they came here to win the Tour, but can you be disappointed as a team with three stage wins, a guy winning the young rider jersey and finished second in the Tour de France? I don't think so.
Into the final 10 kilometres now, and I think it's only two riders up front now. Schachmann is one of them, and Jonas Rutz of EF is the other. Who's over there, Francois? Bahrain victorious. I mean, a pretty lukewarm tour for them, really, bar Fred Wright's performances. Second at Saint-Étienne in the break and looking really good a couple of days ago at Cahors, and eighth in the time trial yesterday. But you know, Matti Mohoric, very quiet. Luis Leon Sanchez doing it for the old guys, 14th overall and a third place at Megève. Dylan Turns had some moments, but they lost Jack Haig on the cobbled stage for a crash, and Damiano Caruso with COVID. A disappointing tour for them, considering what they had come into it hoping for, a high overall finish for Haig.
Yeah, well, Jack Haig, very unlucky. It's the second year in succession that he's out of the tour with a crash. Last year they had four stage wins, none this year. Fred Wright was the only, you know, light in the tunnel, in a way. I mean, it's strange. I mean, I'm not, you know, don't think about anything about what I'm going to say, but the two teams who had, you know, kind of doping implications at the start of this tour or during this tour, as Bahrain, because they were raided by the French gendarmes before the tour, and Astana, where, you know, Miguel Angel Angel Lopez questioned by the police. They underperformed. Of course, no relation whatsoever between the two facts, but that's it. And very strange to see Bahrain, who were so dominant last year, and with all those wins, being so pedestrian in this Tour de France.
AG2R Citroën. Bob Jungels saved their tour for them, really. I mean, it was extraordinary that he was positive for COVID. He was the first rider that was allowed to carry on despite having COVID but being symptomless. I think I'm right in saying that. But he won a phenomenal stage win at Châtel and clawed his way up into 12th place overall, despite not really being in the overall race. But they had some really tough days. I mean, Ben O'Connor was struggling right from the off, and eventually pulled out, had a spate of COVID positives. Cosnefroy and Paris-Peintre have been very quiet. I think Paris-Peintre is out of the race, isn't he? But I think they're finishing with just three riders as well.
Yeah, I mean, Bob Jungels really, you know, saved the tour for them. Really, I mean, one of the most depleted teams at this Tour de France, for a team that had, you know, real ambitions. We're happy because Bob Jungels was one of the Buffalo's favorite riders. He was always mentioning Bob Jungels in when we were making predictions ahead of some of our, you know, time trials or classics. And well, Bob Jungels, at long last, after really struggling with vein problems, you know, finally has made it, and it's great for the future.
The riders have just gone through the finish line, hearing the bell, one lap to go on the Champs-Élysées. The two leaders have been caught, so the peloton all back together, 6.5 kilometres. Well, that's the length of the lap, isn't it? What about Team DSM? Romain Bardet had, he was up and down on the escalator, wasn't he, when, looking really, really good after the Col du Granon stage where he was third, and that put him second overall. But he went up and down and eventually managed to finish in seventh place. No real stage results other than that to talk of, except for Alberto Dainese's third place in Cahors, I suppose, as we're coming down to the final sprint for the line, or are we? Dainese is an outside chance for a stage win here on the Champs-Élysées. But DSM, with putting everything into an overall bid for Romain Bardet, I suppose it meant that they weren't chasing stages as they had done in the past to very good effect a few years ago. 2020, the lockdown tour, they were exceptional, of course.
Yeah, another team that really didn't know what they were, you know, trying to do on this tour, because, I mean, Bardet said from the beginning that he was not going for GC, that he was chasing stage wins. And very early, he found himself so well placed in the GC that, you know, stage wins were out of the question. And after that, it was finished. He was trying to have the best GC position. Andreas Lecknesund was seen, you know, in breaks and trying hard from time to time. But overall, I guess they're probably a better GC finish by Bardet than they expected, but unfortunately no stage win.
Well, we've got three teams to wrap up. We'll do that after we've watched the finish of the stage. We've just seen Ineos go to the front with around 5.5 kilometres to go, and Tadej Pogacar in the white jersey causing some splits at the front. So the race is really on now. Obviously, some people are trying to... what are Ineos trying to do? Are they trying to set up Filippo Ganna, maybe, for a sort of Cancellara-style effort? We'll have to watch and see. Under 5 kilometres to go now. We'll wrap up the stage after this.
Science in Sport is supporting the cycling podcast at the 2022 Tour de France. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for supporting the cycling podcast. As ever, you can get 25% off everything at scienceinsport.com with the discount code SISCP25. Francois, we've just watched the sprint on the Champs-Élysées. Bike Exchange looked to have it really well organised. Luka Mezcek pulled off and left Dylan Groenewegen. Maybe did he leave him a little bit too much to do? Because Jasper Philipsen came up on the other side of the road for Alpecin de Koenig and got his second stage win of the race after winning at Carcassonne last Sunday, wasn't it? So he's won two Sundays in a row. He's also had two second places and a third as well. And when you consider how few opportunities there have really been for sprinters, that is a very good haul. And really salvages the Tour de France for Alpecin de Koenig, because Mathieu van der Poel was very much under par for the week that he was in the race. He pulled out on the Col de Granon stage, looked a shadow of him, saw myself, and especially when you compare him with the other two from the great cyclocross generation, Wout van Aert and Tom Pidcock. A very disappointing tour for van der Poel, but a great one for Jasper Philipsen.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, he was to blame for one of the freak incidents of this Tour de France, when he celebrated victory, when actually Wout van Aert had attacked, and he didn't know that, and, you know, van Aert won his first stage on this Tour de France. This time he didn't celebrate before he'd won. You know, he really did it in great style and in kind of a swashbuckling fashion. I think he was probably, for what we saw, and given his second place as well behind Van Aert that day, probably the most consistent sprinter in this Tour de France, and that's it. One thing to note is that because we're talking about Van Aert, he didn't go for Paris double after winning the Champs-Élysées last year. Obviously, the aim of the game today was to make sure Jonas Vingegaard crossed the line safely, and so Van Aert didn't even try to indulge in a sprint today. He had done more than enough throughout the Tour de France, and congrats to him, of course.
Two more teams to sum up, Francois. Ineos Grenadiers, again, on paper, they would say, if you offered them third place at the start of the Tour, they probably would have taken that, because they weren't coming in with one of the big favourites. Geraint Thomas, 36 years old, and even after the result in the Tour de Suisse where he won there, I'm not sure I thought he was capable still of finishing on the podium. You thought differently, Francois. I'm happy to say you were right. Geraint Thomas finishing third. Adam Yates 10th, although maybe a little bit disappointing here and there. The star performance, though, from the team was Tom Pidcock winning on Alpe d'Huez. The descent of the Galibier was the sort of thing that does, it gets people hooked on the edge of their seats, and all those other cliches. I can imagine kids watching that and thinking, wow, cycling's a sport for me, because that's the sort of thing that really caught my attention when I was a kid. Philippe Ogana 4th and 5th in the two time trials, but a pretty good tour for Ineos Grenadiers, but not what they're used to, I guess.
Well, I mean, they set the bar, so high in the past that, every performance outside from winning the Tour is seen as a kind of a disappointment. On the podium again, after being on the podium last year with the Richard Carapaz, maybe not with the guy they were expecting. I mean, Dani Martinez was probably the big disappointment. He had health issues as well, and was much better in the last week in the Pyrenees. But I mean, when you have the guy on the podium, a guy in 10th place, and you win the stage in L'Alpe d'Huez with one of the most exciting young talents of the peloton, you can't really be disappointed.
And we've left the best team in the race till last. Jumbo-Visma not winning the team classification, but winning the yellow jersey and the polka dot jersey with Jonas Vingegaard, winning those six stages, three of them for Wout van Aert, two of them for Vingegaard, and one for Christophe Laporte in Cahors. Vingegaard's been in yellow since cracking Tadej Pogacar on the Col de Granon. Wout van Aert, of course, had the yellow jersey at the start. He's been in green since Denmark. I mean, they've had their disappointments and difficulties as well, haven't they? Primoz Roglic with the incident with the hay bale on the cobbled stage, pulling out of the race after a couple of weeks. Kruiswijk out, and Nathan van Hooijdonk out as well. There was a nice moment where they were riding on the front of the peloton as they came into Paris today, and one of the Jumbo-Visma riders held up Van Hooydonk's number just to acknowledge the part that he's played in Vingegaard's win. And as you say, Van Aert not going for, you know, even cannibals are satisfied eventually, I guess. But an incredible tour for them.
Yes, I mean, you know, everything went according to plan for them. Textbook performance from A to Z. I mean, from in the past, there was always something going wrong, you know, for them. In spite of the strengths were there, the luck, the tactics, you know, health issues. I mean, there was always a little something going wrong during the Pogacar years. I mean, we remember Roglic losing on the last day to Pogacar, and last year Roglic again pulling out, and Vingegaard revealing himself, but, you know, maybe a little bit tender yet to tackle Pogacar. And this time, really, I mean, there were very, very few moments of, you know, well, on the cobbles. Yeah, they had a bad day on the cobbles, but, and that's what's important when you're the best team in the tour. You manage to save, you know, what can be saved on the bad days, and they did it very well. So, yeah, nothing to say. I mean, you know, when you look at the results, what they won, on which terrains they won, taking almost all the jerseys in on offer except the young rider that Pogacar won, you can hardly do any better.
There was a spiky moment or two in the press conference yesterday with Vingegaard and Van Aert, and we'll talk about that when we debrief. We'll catch up on the official results and just make sure we haven't missed anything from everything that's gone on as they've crossed the line there. And I mean, I'm not anticipating that Louis Menkes has jumped up a couple of places or Romain Bardet slipped down or anything, but we will just double check the results. We'll have an end of the tour beer and a recap a little bit later on, Francois, but let's go and wander around the team buses. Well, Francois, we're back in the bar. The Tour de France is now over. It's... Why are you laughing? I mean, we do spend a lot of time recording podcasts in bars.
You know, but it sounded like, you know, now the Tour de France is over, you know, back to normal, we're back in the bar.
Let's move on. As we said, Jasper Philipsen won the stage ahead of Dylan Groenewegen. I said we'd recap how the rest of the top 10 looked. Alexander Kristoff was up there in third place. Jasper Stuyven fourth. Peter Sagan fifth. Jeremy Le Croc sixth. I feel a little bit mean about taking the mickey about his time trial performance now. Danny Van Poppel seventh. Caleb Ewan eighth. Ugo Hofstetter another ninth place. I mean, you can set your watch by Ugo Hofstetter finishing ninth, and Fred Wright 10th, which is perfect for us because the Pedaleur de Charme award has been voted for by the public on Twitter. All of our listeners have voted, and Fred Wright has won convincingly ahead of Magnus Cort for his attacking never say die spirit. So we will get one of Stacey Snyder's beautiful Pedaleur de Charme cups to Fred Wright at the earliest opportunity. Well done, Fred. Speaking of Stacey's cups, the Tour de France fan batch of cups and cappuccino sets and espresso sets and whiskey cups go on sale tomorrow, Monday, at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, US, which is 3 p.m. UK time and 4 p.m. in Central Europe. So go to Stacey Snyder's Etsy page. There's a link on our website, thecyclingpodcast.com. You're going to have to be quick, though. But the mugs with the buffalo motif on, they're sure to sell out quickly. Now, before we go, Francois, what were your thoughts about yesterday's press conference? Because Jonas Vingegaard and Wout van Aert faced a couple of spiky questions about doping. We were commenting about how the doping question really hadn't been posed to Vingegaard throughout this tour. A number of reasons for that, perhaps. But what did you think of the press conference yesterday evening?
Yeah, I mean, Kate Wagner, you know, who's, whom you know from, you know, the cycling podcast. She comes from time to time. She's a friend of ours. She did her job. She did the job, you know, that should have been done before. I think it was not a nasty doping question. It was an interesting question. The question was, to sum it up, why, you know, every time there was a performance on the Tour de France in the last decade, in the last years, I mean, for the last 25 years, there was always doping questions coming up. Why, in this Tour de France, did we have to wait for the very last press conference to have a doping question? It is. I mean, in a way, it is. It is, you know, kind of a homage to Jumbo-Visma that no allegation, no suggestion that doping might be involved had come to anybody's mind before the last day. So, you know, just to ask that question, how I would have worded it a little bit differently. I wanted, if Kate Wagner had not asked the question, I would have asked the question. I would have said, Jonas, there's always doping questions at press conference in the Tour de France, almost daily for the past 25 years. There was not any one throughout this Tour de France. Why do you think that is? I mean, I think that's and then I think he might have had, you know, answers saying, well, the competition was open, there was action every day, it was not over dominant. I mean, Pogacar was always fighting. You know, there was not. I think that probably doping allegations get more, how could I say, present, valid, or seem valid when there's one guy dominating the rest of the field. It was a case for Chris Froome. Chris Froome never won a Tour de France without, you know, his performances being put into doubt. Tadej Pogacar was, I mean, we didn't have the time to question his performances in his first Tour win because he was only leading the Tour on the last day. But there were certainly in the last Tour many, many allegations and suspicions around Tadej Pogacar. I mean, you know, his coach was interviewed. The past of the UAE Emirates was scrutinized because, as we know, Mauro Gianetti, Machen Fernandez have a doping past record. But in this case, nobody questioned the past of Jumbo-Visma, which used to be Rabobank. The last Danish yellow jersey holder was Michael Rasmussen. The last winner of Tour de France was Bjarne Riis. And how come Vingegaard seems to be kind of a virgin of all these, you know, immune of all these links and with the past, and that's a question in itself. I myself don't think there is anything dodgy about Jonas Vingegaard. I don't know. I don't have any proof. Nothing seems to me extraordinary, except probably the pace of the Tour, the fastest Tour ever. But yeah, that's an interesting point in itself. I mean, you know, dear listeners, as Chiro would say, how come the shadow, the cloud of doping that's been, you know, roaming over the Tour de France for so long, well, how come it was, you know, it was not there in this Tour?
Yeah, I think the team itself has done well to break with the past. I mean, the Jumbo-Visma team has evolved out of Rabobank, which was effectively brought down by doping scandal. I mean, Rabobank pulled out as a result of the doping scandals, and the Michael Rasmussen, you know, getting within sight of Paris in 2007 in the yellow jersey and then being pulled out of the race. But I think the team has done a good job. The organisation has done a good job of having a break from the past. Almost nobody from that era remains. I mean, Franz Masson rode for the team in its past incarnation. Grisha Neerman rode for the team. But organisationally, they did have a kind of a reset after the Blanco-Belkin period. And then Jumbo-Visma was almost a refresh. Wout van Aert was asked by our colleague Johnny Long a question about doping as well. And I wasn't terribly impressed with van Aert's response. I mean, he described it as a shit question. Why do we always have to face this question? I don't think it is a shit question. I think it's a question that the riders, however unfair they feel, it's a question they have to engage with. And if they're struggling to understand why it's being asked, then Wout van Aert could ask some older people in the team, riders from the 90s or the 2000s, why am I getting asked this question? Because the history of cycling tells you exactly why that question is asked. On the other hand, if Van Aert is training and racing completely clean, I can completely understand him feeling aggrieved at being asked the question and having the finger pointed at him that his performances are so good that they must not be on the level. So it's a tricky one. And I think in cycling, we can't have an era of superstars. We can't lord Wout van Aert as kind of the Swiss Army knife of cycling, who can do almost everything. and then when they actually get the result over the line and they put the yellow jersey in the suitcase, then say, ah, but hang on a minute, you know, the questions have to be asked. So I think it's a really tricky balance. I would also say on this tour, I mean, the COVID tour was difficult, but this has been a kind of COVID tour. The journalists have been kicked out of the team bus area in the starts since the end of the first week. There has been less access to riders and team management. I don't want to get into the kind of the how we work every day, but the finish area is different to the start area. So there isn't that opportunity for the kind of the longer, more informal, more relaxed conversation with team staff about what's going on in the race. And so there does feel like there's a bit of a barrier in between the media and the riders and the staff. But
there's another interesting thing about that question. In the past 20 years, since the Festina scandal, you always got let's say the things as they are, because once again, I won't be in that business very long, so I can say this type of things. Most of the allegations, suspicions, and accusations you heard from journalists come from riders. You know, usually when some guys, oh, look at, you know, that team, or look at that rider, the insinuations come from talking to other riders who say, look, this guy is not doing things properly. And actually, our sources on a lot of doping allegations, doping stories, or doping suspicions are not just fancies, or they don't crop up from our imagination. It's come from other teams questioning the performances of other teams. Comes from riders questioning the performances. I mean, riders in the bunch should know better than we do. So if sometimes they feel something is dodgy, they probably have grounds to make these allegations. To be honest, in this Tour de France, I didn't hear that many allegations by Jumbo Visma or by anybody or Tadej Pogacar. So the other riders seem to respect what Jumbo Visma are doing, what all the riders performing well are doing, as legitimate, as clean, which is probably one of the reasons why the question has not been posed in the first place.
Yeah, I think we're on a sticky wicket if we use excellence as a catalyst for suspicion. I mean, somebody has to be the best. We've said this all the way, you know, through the last number of years. And I guess what you're saying, Francois, is that, you know, there isn't the kind of the smoke of suspicion around Jumbo-Visma that perhaps we've had around other teams and other riders in past years. But it's a question that does still need to be asked at the Tour de France, and I think that the riders need to understand the historical context of why those questions get asked, and hats off to Kate and to Johnny Long for asking those questions in the press conference yesterday. Speaking of Kate Wagner, we've got a Kilometre Zero episode that she's been making this week, which will go out, I think, on Monday, possibly Tuesday, depending on how quickly we can get it made. Let's be transparent about it, but that will be out very soon. And Francois, we're nearly at the end of the Tour de France. It's nearly time to go to the Brasserie Mollard, where we're going to have our final Tour de France meal. Will it be a good one?
Yeah, I mean, I love Parisian brasseries. I wrote a book about them. There's even an English version if you look for it. Mollard is the decor. The place is beautiful. It's from the early 20th century, and they were trying at the time. There was a trend. Well, there was Art Nouveau, of course, and this is very Art Nouveau. But there was also a trend to try and call neo Moorish. They were trying to do this kind of exotic, you know, Middle East style. So actually, this restaurant looked like Turkish bath in a way. Well, hopefully it'll be a little bit cooler than a Turkish bath. But yeah, and the food is, you know, typical Parisian brasserie. It's quite trad, you know, pretty simple and classic, but usually very well done. So yeah, looking forward to it.
Well, we really ought to get there, Francois, for our final Tour de France meal. That just leaves me to say thank you to a few people. First of all, and most importantly, thank you to all the listeners for tuning in during the Tour de France again this year, and also for your messages either by email or social media. Really appreciate every bit of feedback that we get. A special thanks to our friends of the podcast, because you've carried on supporting us, and well, we haven't yet delivered any of the Friends of the Podcast episodes since the spring, well, for obvious reasons. We've been you know, working out how to put together the podcast without Richard Moore, for one thing, but we will be delivering some Friends of the Podcast episodes at the end of the year. So thank you very much for your continued support. Thank you very much to Mitch and to Ian for their insight and company during the Tour de France. I really enjoyed my week with Mitch. Very sad that I only had one day with Ian. A big thank you to Rose for holding things together so brilliantly while I was unable to be on the tour. Thank you to our friends of the podcast who popped in from time to time, Ed and Kate and Julian, and Ciro Scognamiglio, of course. A big thank you to David Luxton and everyone at David Luxton Associates for their support. Our production team, we couldn't make the podcast without them. They are absolutely fantastic night after night. Adam Bowie, John Mooney, Will Jones, Hugh Owen and Tom Wally. And of course, our sponsors, without whom we wouldn't be here. Super Sapiens, Science in Sport, MAP and the people at Audio Boom who host all of our episodes. But the biggest thank you is to you, Francois. You've been saying that this will be your final full Tour de France, and well, I have no reason to doubt you, but I hope that you'll join us for maybe a few days. Perhaps if the tour passes Marseille, you'll jump into the nest and stay with us for a few days and continue your contribution to the cycling podcast, because this year, above all, your willingness to do the full 3 weeks, because I know retirement was half on your mind last year, but after Richard died, you committed to the full 3 weeks, and frankly the podcast wouldn't have got to Paris without you. Your insight, your humour, your laid back attitude to life has been a big help to me over the last week, certainly, and it's been an absolute pleasure and a privilege to travel with you since Dusseldorf in 2017, and so I hope you'll be back for a few stages next year.
Well, it's almost definitely my last Tour de France, I mean as a whole, but it's not my last, it's not the last time you hear my voice on the podcast, for sure.
Very glad to hear that. Well, that is it for the 2022 Tour de France. We're going to play out with the Tour de Buffalo, and well, Richard always had the honour of saying farewell at the end of every episode of our Tour de France coverage, and this is a little montage put together by our producer Tom Wally, a kind of greatest hits of the farewells from Paris by Richard Moore.
The Tour du Buffalo, remembering Richard Moore.
That's all for the 2018 Tour de France for now. Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Francois.
Merci, les gars.
We did a bit of ABBA. We covered lots of bases.
I nearly went for a winner takes it all, because it really would have applied to Kav, but he didn't win this thing.
Kav, Pogacar with his jerseys on the podium, Wout van Aert. There were two kind of big winners, weren't there?
Would have applied,
Mitch,
yeah.
Nothing to stop you now singing us out with the winner takes
I actually,
it
yeah, I don't know the lyrics to that one.
I mean, I think on this note, bye-bye.
Yes, thank you very much, Francois.
Thanks, Richard.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
You were going through the hotel list there, and it does conjure up all these great memories that you forget the next day, but then you look back and they all come flooding back. And you know, the podcast stand is a audio record of this Tour de France, hopefully. Anyway, let's wrap things up, shall we, Lionel? It's farewell from Paris and farewell from the 2016 Tour de France.
Yeah, it's sad, isn't it? But we'll get the Eurostar home tomorrow, and we'll miss being here by about tomorrow afternoon. Although, we'll be back again next year, but see what we can conjure up for the Welter, shall we?
Cheer up, Lionel. It'll all come round again sometime soon.
Yeah.
Cheerio.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you to you, Richard.
Thanks, Lionel. Thanks to you, Orla.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks, Simon. Thank you, Lionel. Thank you, Lionel. Thank you, listeners.
Thank you, listeners. Thank you very much, listeners, who have listened in record numbers this year, and we're very grateful to that. We'll be back soon. Thank you.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.
Thank you.